Good afternoon. It's 1:30 on Wednesday, January 25th, and I call House Finance to order, and President or Representative Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Gren, Representative Guttenberg. And I'll remind everybody about their cell phones again, and just a reminder for presenters not to use acronyms, and they're just missed by many people that may be observing this committee meeting. So today we'll introduce and hold the governor's operating budget HB 57 and mental health budget HB 59, and so I'm proposing a committee substitute with just technical corrections for each bill. Co-Chair Foster.
Okay. And you asked for a motion, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I move that the committee adopt as its work draft CS for House Bill 57 Finance 30-GH1855/J Wallace, January 23, 2017.
And thank you. Is there any objection? Seeing none, we will adopt this version as our working draft, and now I'd like to have David Teal come forward to explain the technical corrections in HB 57. And before we start there, I'd like to recognize that Representative Thompson and Representative Tilton have joined us. And Mr. Teal, would you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division. Before you, you have a document compare. In addition to the committee substitute bill, that document compare is something that we've been working with legal services on and the chairman's office on. The reason it's in document compare form is because there is nothing in this committee substitute that differs from the governor's original bill in any significant way. So I'm not going to walk through every change here. The bottom line is that there are no transaction changes. What you'll see are a number of date corrections. There were half a dozen or so dates that should have been updated. Legal services changed those. There are some editing changes where they put it in legal services form rather than Department of Law form. Still says the same thing. And the transactions in our budget system have not changed at all. So essentially, this bill gives us a clean start in a legal services format of the governor's bill. And I don't see Pat Pitney or Kelly from OMB. They were going to come over to testify that they have reviewed the bill, the changes, and that they agree that the bill does no more, no less than what the governor's original format did. And so this bill, the CS, becomes the basis for your amendments, but it is the governor's bill in a slightly modified format.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Teal? And would you remain at table for the next bill, Ms. Teal? And Pat, would you come forward? Welcome to House Finance.
Thank you. For the record, Pat Pitney.
We are looking at the work draft of House Bill 57, Finance, and I think that you've gotten a copy of that as well as the side-by-side of the changes. And we just wanted to verify from OMB's perspective that there are no substantial changes other than wording and technical changes, and any dates are, you agree with those changes.
Thank you, and Chairman Seaton, we do agree with the bill represents the intent of what we had submitted in our original bill, so there are no material changes, just cleanups and clarity.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that. Is there any questions for Ms. Pitney? Seeing none, thank you for that. You might as well stay there because we have. So with that, we have the House Bill 57 before the committee, and now we will, Representative Foster, do you have a motion?
Sure, thank you. Okay, I move that the committee adopt as its work draft CS for House Bill 59, Finance, 30-GH1856-D, Wallace, January 23, 2017.
Okay, thank you. Is there any objection to the adoption of the CS as a working draft? Seeing none, Ms. Teal, would you again explain the, not the technical corrections, but the process and what we have before us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The process on this bill was identical to the operating budget. This, of course, is a mental health bill. And again, as you look through the bill, there are fewer changes to it. And you'll note that in the margins, most of those changes have to do with formatting things that we would like to have crossed out to make it easier to see changes that might be a little more significant. But we decided that it was best to just leave the electronic compare exactly as it is so that we didn't mistakenly delete one of the little bubbles and cause any confusion. But each of you may wish to go through and look at the changes that were made if you want to take the time to do it. But again, the bills do identical things. It may be reordered, but that's it.
Okay, thank you. And Ms. Pitney, you've reviewed the documents, and do you agree from OMB's perspective that this is really the bill as submitted by the governor with technical realignments?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for either Ms. Teal or Ms. Pitney? Representative Guerra.
Mr. Chair, it's only up to you. I have a question about the mental health bill and how it comes about. I've run into a number of members who also do. Would you mind if we spend like 3 minutes on it, if I can do this in 3 minutes.
Representative Guerra, go ahead.
Thank you. For either of you, so I understand perfectly well that there has to be a separate mental health budget, and I understand that that started based on a court order, and I have no problem with that. I'm just trying to understand how the parameters of the mental health budget end up in the mental health budget instead of the operating budget. Last year, there was a disabilities item that was funded by undesignated general funds that was in the mental health budget. And so I'm wondering, certainly I understand that things funded by the mental health trust end up in the mental health budget. Certainly I understand it relates to mental health issues. But what is the dividing line between what ends up in the mental health budget as opposed to the operating budget on mental health items? Because it did surprise me last year when I saw that one UGF item and one of the subcommittees proposed cutting it, but it was UGF and it had to do with, it was a disabilities grant that was mental health related. Where's the dividing line between whether something ends up in the mental health budget and the operating budget?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I would say that it has built up a kind of a traditional. It's as the other operating budget is also a base plus. This was a base plus increments or decrements, and over time there's been this distinction, and I don't I'll have to defer to Director Teal if there's a hard boundary. I believe there's a fair amount of discretion. But it represents also the priorities of the Mental Health Trust Board and their guidance. So it is – I don't think there's a hard and fast, this has to be here or has to be there.
Okay, I'm going to take that as a we don't really know. Mr. Thiel, thank you, through the chair, sorry. And then, sure, David, but also I know some of their priorities and the operating budget, too, so it's not just priorities.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. The reason we don't know is because it's all done by a computer.
And you know, that's as long as I'm not the only person who doesn't know, that's fine. That's all I really wanted to know.
And we do know. It's divided by fund codes. So that there is a group of fund codes that are mental health. The MHTAR, the Mental Health Trust receipts, there's unrestricted GF general funds in the mental health bill. They are coded typically with GF/MH to designate that. There may be match, there may be some other fund codes, but basically if it's a mental health fund group, then it automatically switches over to the mental health bill. That's why you'll see mostly health and social services code or allocations, and the same allocations will appear in the regular operating budget and in the mental health bill. All it's done is taken the mental health fund group, pull it from the regular operating budget, and put it into the mental health bill. And with capital, that dividing line is less certain because you may have different fund sources, but those are projects that were proposed by the Mental Health Trust Board. The governor has to forward them to us or give us a letter saying why he didn't forward the Mental Health Trust Board's request. Same at the end of session. We have to write a letter for the chairman's signature telling what was left out of the mental health budget or the Mental Health Trust request and why. So it's, as you say, it is a requirement in law that the bills have to be separated, but they're taken up together. You amend them at the same time. They go to the same conference committee, and I'm sure that if there weren't a statute that said you needed separate bills, there wouldn't be a separate bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in the Mental Health Trust on page 2, have we always had the collective bargaining of our unions in the mental health budget?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes. Any time that members of that bargaining association are funded with mental health funds, the same language that's in the regular operating bill is repeated in the mental health. And since we don't generally know exactly who's where, we've tended to repeat all of the bargaining units, even if it's irrelevant to the mental health fund group.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow-up, Wilson.
Because I didn't think some of them were in there, so that kind of threw me off. But so as far as the wording would be the same here and in the operating budget, and also talking about reducing proportionally of the amount for the bargaining agreements if we haven't reached an agreement, that is for both budgets, not just one.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you very much.
Are there further questions? Seeing no further questions, we'll have the CS for us for our operating document, and thank you both for coming forward. Now we would like to take a very brief of these to set up for a presentation by here we go. We're back in order, and we will have Gunnar Knapp to introduce himself and his presentation. The meeting will have to end at 3:30, so we have a fair amount of time, but make sure that everybody we've got a clock up here, too, so that you can schedule your time. Do you want to take questions as you go through, or do you want to go through?
I'm happy to take questions as I go through. If it's sort of going, if I'm not going to finish, I'll say I better move it along a little faster.
Okay, that would be fine. So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and then we'll proceed.
Great. Hi, folks. My name is Gunnar Knapp, and I'm the former director and former professor of economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute of Social and Economic Research, or ICER, and now I'm a professor emeritus because I retired at the end of June. And so you might go, well, what am I doing here? So basically, I got kind of interested in this fiscal stuff over the past several years and did a lot of work on it, and I thought, well, I should try to keep involved in studying this stuff and be helpful if I can. I guess you could say I failed retirement or whatever, but it's some convoluted idea that this is something I can do to be useful. But all my work on this is completely voluntary. I'm not getting paid by anybody. So that's where I'm coming from. I'm just trying to be helpful in sharing what I can on this. And I would also emphasize that all the opinions I'm stating are my own. I mean, I'm sort of affiliated with ICER as a professor emeritus, but that's sort of an honorary designation. As always, I'm not representing them or the university or anybody else. So I got a long list of sort of slides at the beginning that I would bore you with, so I'm just going to rush through them and just make a few real quick points and try to get to the meat of this thing. My main goal was to come up with a way that I could compare different fiscal proposals that are under discussion. And so I thought, well, I'll just make a little model to do that. And then several legislators asked me, well, could I help them model what they were talking about? And the next thing I knew, I'd come up with a sort of big complicated model. And then I got invited to talk here about it. So I'm going to talk about that. And I want to emphasize what I'm doing. Absolutely, I'm not advocating for or against any fiscal proposal. I realize there's a very wide range of things people are talking about, and I'm just interested in saying, if you run the numbers on this thing, what happens? But I'm not here to argue this way of doing it or this way. I'm just trying to help you, you guys and myself, and sort of see what do these things look like. My focus is on unrestricted general fund spending and then also potential uses of permanent fund earnings, and I don't get at all into other parts of the budget. I'm not going to talk at all about oil credits or oil taxes. Basically, the way my model handles those is if you changed oil credits, that would show up in my model as a change in spending. If you changed oil taxes, that would show up in my model as a change in revenues. So that's how you'd work it in the finances. I think it's useful to, as you think about the challenge we're facing, to take a look at, well, this is probably a familiar graph to you, but I think it shows us a lot of interesting things. This is since oil began flowing, on a per capita adjusted for inflation basis, what our revenues have been and what our spending has been. So the revenue part is the blue lines at the bottom and the red lines. The blue is the non-oil revenues, the red is the oil revenues. And so what you see is that we had two huge oil booms, one in the early 80s and then another one, 8 to 15 or 13 or whatever. And they're pretty sort of similar in terms of the, value per Alaskan. So we had these periods where we had a lot of money, and then after them we had periods where the money just slid down, okay? And then the two lines show the agency spending per capita, that's the bottom line, and the total spending per capita. The purple line is the higher line, and the difference between them is the capital budget and statewide operations. And what you can see is that, say, if you think, well, what's been Alaska's fiscal policy over this historical period? You can see, well, you might describe it like this. Our policy was, when we had more money, we would spend more money. And in particular, we would grow both budgets, both the operating and the capital, but in particular, we'd grow the capital. And then when we had less money, we'd cut back on both budgets, but in particular, the capital. And then when we had a long period of decline, we squeezed the agency spending down, we squeezed the capital spending down, and we went at a certain point from running surpluses to running deficits. And so everybody was all panicking in the late 90s and early 2000s because we'd been running these progressive deficits and drawing down our savings. And then the cycle repeated itself, and that gets us, and I need to update this graph by year, that gets us to our present situation. You might go, well, what's different? And to me, what's different is this time our revenues have fallen to a much lower level, and probably there's less prospect that they'll come back. So that leaves us with this question, well, what are we going to do? Can we? To me, it looks like it's going to be impossible to squeeze that spending down to this level of revenues. So the question is, well, what do we do? And that leads, and you know, everybody's aware that we've been paying for these deficits by drawing down the savings. So now we're talking about, well, we've got this permanent fund, which has been growing and growing and growing and generating more and more money. So that leads us to the, and how we've been using that. Historically, we only used it for dividends, and then we would save part of the money as inflation proofing, or we would save part of the money by building up the earnings reserve. But we were clearly not using all our earnings, and that's why the permanent fund was growing so fast. So that leaves us with the question of, which you guys are all aware of, is it time to start using these permanent fund earnings in some way to help address this deficit issue? And so it seems to me all these questions fundamentally, I mean, so part of our fiscal debate is how much can or should we solve this problem by cutting spending or by adding taxes? But then the other part of the question is to what extent can we or should we solve this fiscal problem by starting to use these permanent fund earnings, and if so, in what way? All these proposals are being developed to look at that. So I developed this model and my goal was just a way of comparing these things. And I want to emphasize there's nothing magic whatsoever about this model. It's just a big Excel spreadsheet. And it's just a bunch of formulas that track if you do this, what happens. And the main thing about the way I set it up was I set it up so that I could really quickly just change one number and it would change between plans. Or I could quickly change, you know, all kinds of variables so you can easily use the model and say, what happens if you do this, if you tweak it this way, and so on. I just emphasize that my model and the one I'm showing you is pretty simplistic because the budget is really complicated the way it works. My model is sort of good for a first start, big picture comparison of different proposals, just sort of saying, how's this thing, which is wildly different from this thing, how do they compare? But it is not a substitute in any way for the quite detailed models that have been put together by organizations that have that responsibility and expertise. And in particular, it's not a substitute for what legislative finance is able to model for you. So I would always defer to them for the specifics, and maybe I'll just leave now. Anyway. Okay, so as you look at these, my numbers, if you see a number, that's a number of millions of dollars. Okay, so, and also, this is kind of work in progress, and so I may have errors. I probably do have errors, and so I apologize in advance, and thank you, because by showing you this, you'll point out my errors to me. Now what I want to do is talk a bit about assumptions. So anytime you project something, it's critical what you assume, particularly what's going to happen to oil revenues and what's going to happen to permanent fund rates of return. This is because if you're going to have a model that says this is what our state's finances look like, obviously what you assume about how much oil revenue we're going to have and how much we're going to earn in investments, that's absolutely critical to what kind of results you get. So the question is, well, what do you assume? And if you make your assumptions optimistic enough, you go, well, we don't have a problem. We're going to have a lot of money, so we don't have a problem. We don't have to change anything. Or if you make your assumptions pessimistic enough, well, then you go, oh, we have a huge problem. We're all going to die. The question is, how do you plan for the future when you don't know what our revenues are going to be? So I just want to make a simple point. A lot of times, we tend to act as if the most convenient assumptions to use, which are the most recent Department of Revenue projections and the sort of current permanent fund assumptions based on their advisors, we sort of say, well, those are magic, those are real, and so we'll plan everything based on those. But the fact is, history tells us neither of these assumptions are likely to come true or even remotely true. So let's look at history. We have done really poorly historically in projecting future oil prices. You know, the bars show what actually came true, and then the different lines show what was projected in different years about what our revenues were going to be in the future. And this is not to criticize the people that made these projections. It's just really hard to know where oil prices are going to go 2-3 years out. So we why are we going to do better this time? 2 or 3 years out, the price assumptions are probably going to be way off from what the official ones are. Similarly, it's also really hard to project future oil production more than a few years out. If you look historically, there have been periods where we were way over-optimistic and then other years where it went the other way. So what that means is that if you combine our inability to accurately guess future prices and production, we don't have a very good record at projecting how we're going to what our revenues are going to be in the future. And in fact, if you historically look at what was projected about what general fund unrestricted revenues would be, typically if you go just like 3 years out, you're typically at least 30-40% off one way or the other. So therefore, I would suggest, or I would beg you, that as you discuss all these different fiscal options in our fiscal situation, look at a range of assumptions about what might come true. And don't just sort of rely on one. Sort of say, well, how would that play out if revenues were lower or if revenues were higher? So what is that range of assumptions? So I don't know. I don't know what the right range is. But I think it would be really good for you guys, or maybe a subset of you guys, to sort of try to dig into this a little bit more and get some general idea of, go beyond, the sort of point estimate and sort of say, how likely is it or isn't it that these things will come true? But I'm not going to show you, I can tweak my model all kinds of ways to show the effect of different oil prices, but you all know the effect of different oil prices. If oil prices are higher, we get more money, but it's also been pointed out they have to go a lot higher before we get a lot more money. It seems to me unlikely that oil prices are going to go a lot higher enough to really get us out of our problem. Now, I want to make the same point about permanent fund earnings. Historically, the permanent fund rates of return have fluctuated widely, really widely. And so, yet, whenever you look at projections of what's the permanent fund going to do in the future, it's always sort of, well, it's going to be, like 6.9% or so on. But it's not going to be the same. There's going to be fluctuation. And it's also true that historically, we've seen real changes over time in sort of 10-year averages. So we can't assume that the projections of the permanent fund earnings are going to come true either on a year-to-year basis in particular or in earnings. What can you do? What I suggest is, as you think about different fiscal proposals, think about how would they play out if the permanent fund returns are lower, or if they varied a lot. And so for purposes of illustration, I'm going to show you, for everything I talk about, three different sets of assumptions. And one is at the official, at what the department, what the permanent fund is sort of what projecting for returns, and I'm going to show what's the effect of if they're 1% lower. And then I just arbitrarily took a 10-year period in history, FY06 to 16, and said, suppose hypothetically you got exactly the same returns going forward, starting in FY18, as you got in that 10-year period, what would happen?
Before you go forward, on slide 28, you get three different colors there. Oh, okay, it just doesn't show up on ours here. Fund total revenues, fund real return, and inflation. Okay, thanks. Maybe it's my color perception there. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so I want to start out by just sort of mentioning a few basics about thinking about the permanent fund, because this is sort of basic stuff, but it's important in thinking about any proposal that involves use of permanent fund earnings. So I went through a simple exercise, and I said, what would happen if we didn't take any money at all out of the permanent fund? Okay, suppose you just let the thing grow at the rate of interest, and you didn't pay any dividends, or you didn't have any draws for government. And if you assume what the permanent fund is, their projections, well, then the permanent fund would grow to this huge number of $113 billion by FY27. Right? So that's sort of one way of thinking of kind of the maximum size that the permanent fund would grow to if we didn't draw from it at all. On the other hand, the more we draw from it, well, the more money we get, either as dividends or for government, but the less it grows. And so you have that trade-off. The more we draw, the more will come in less than this. Now, the way this graph works on the right, the realized earnings are shown in blue, and in this I don't have any inflation proofing. I just sort of said, suppose you accumulated all earnings in the realized earnings, and that's where the growth would be. Now, some people talk about So this, by the way, shows what happens if you lower by 1%. If you lower the rate of return by 1%, why, then you end up with $13 billion less, in FY27. So every percent rate of return on average makes a real difference in how much growth you get. Now what happens if you throw in sort of varying rates of return like we had in FY06 to 17? Well, you still get growth, but the point is that the growth is much more varied. Okay, and that's pretty obvious. Now, some people say, well, we should be inflation proofing. Okay, so in this graph, I showed what happens if you inflation proof. Well, what is inflation proofing? It's simply taking money from one part of the permanent fund and putting in another part of the permanent fund. And so you're taking money from the earnings reserve, which you're allowed to spend, into the principal, which you're not allowed to spend. So it doesn't change how much the permanent fund earns. It doesn't change the permanent fund value. All it does is it takes money off the table. It keeps it safer. Okay? But the point is, so you might think of inflation proofing. The question about inflation proofing is, how much money do we want to take off the table to make sure that the principal is safe from evil us who might want to steal it? If you put it in inflation proofing, it doesn't actually make the permanent fund any bigger. It just puts it in a different part where we can't get at it as easily. Okay, I'm not going to talk any more about inflation proofing. The rest of my talk, I just sort of assume we don't do any inflation proofing. Now let's look at this question. Suppose we don't inflation proof, but we don't have any government draws. Okay, we don't take any money out for government. We just say we're going to keep the dividend formula as it is. Okay, and so we're just going to go on using the permanent fund the way we had been using it, and we're not going to touch the permanent fund for anything else. So if you have that level of draw, then the permanent fund, quote, only grows to, $82 billion by FY27, but you get all these dividends out. So the point is that and it's pretty obvious, dividends are not using up the entire permanent fund earnings, right? There's extra money, Okay, there's actually, if you want to think of that, there's extra money that we could potentially use and still have a very large permanent fund. But the more we dip into that extra money, the less the permanent fund will grow. And so the more we take money out now, the less it will generate in the future in earnings. Okay, now I want to go and look at, use my model to sort of show some hypothetical proposals. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you through five so-called fiscal proposals, which are just sort of combinations of things you might do to spending revenues, drawing money from the permanent fund earnings for the general fund, and dividends, okay? And two of them are, the first two I'm going to talk about are completely hypothetical, and they're for purposes of illustration, and I'll explain what the illustration are. And then the last three are my rather clumsy attempts to model Senator Dunleavy's proposal, the HB 365, and the governor's proposal. But I want to emphasize that my attempts to model these last three proposals represent kind of my understanding, which may not be correct, of how these proposals work, and it may not be what these people have in mind. I might have it wrong, so you should not look at what I said this proposal does as sort of necessarily the accurate thing, because I don't know the details of exactly what they're assuming. Also, these things are all in flux. But hopefully what I'm going to show you is good enough to give you a general sense of my point is mainly to illustrate and contrast the approaches that these different proposals take.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, so let's first look at
Representative Wilson.
Could you just tell me what HB 365 is?
That's what I don't know if I'm allowed to say it's Representative Seaton's proposal.
There was a proposal last year that was presented to House Finance.
Yeah. That's what I thought, but I thought the public might be wondering how we got to 365 already.
Appreciate it. That's old.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, so my first hypothetical proposal is what I call the cut and tax only. Okay, and so this is the hypothetical. It's just a thought exercise. And it said, suppose you said, by God, I'm going to eliminate the deficit immediately, and I'm not going to go touch the permanent fund at all. I refuse to touch permanent fund earnings. I'm just going to just do it by cutting spending and raising taxes. And what the hell, I'll do it 50-50. So I'll take the deficit. I'll take whatever deficit there is, you know, from now compared with current revenue sources, and I'll split the difference, and I'll get rid of half of it by cutting spending and half of it by cutting taxes, raising taxes. So my main point is that I just want to. Oh, by the way, this is your first chance to look at all these very small type graphs.
Yeah.
Let me explain what they are. I'm too familiar with these. The model is depicted really in the upper left-hand graph. Okay, that shows what are you spending and how are you paying for it. Okay, and the top green line in that graph says what you're spending. Okay, and then the yellow line, or I don't know if that's whatever that color is, line in the middle shows what your revenues are coming in. And in this, let's see. Yeah, the yellow line shows, the current revenue sources. So the current revenue sources are the oil revenues, which are the black part at the bottom, and the blue is the current non-oil revenues. So that's the part at the bottom. That's the Department of Revenue's projections of what our current revenue sources would get us. And so in this model, what I've done is I said, okay, I'm going to do two things. One, I'm going to slash that green spending line. I'm going to cut that down by half the amount of the deficit. And second, I'm going to add this big chunk of new taxes. And what's the point? It's mainly to show you if you wanted to solve it that way, if you said, I'm going to get rid of this deficit and I'm just going to solve it without going to the permanent fund,
you have to do big, really big spending cuts or really big new taxes or some combination. And if you make, if you do less taxes, then you have to do even bigger spending cuts or vice versa. So it's a, it, somebody said it's a big problem, and it's hard to solve just by some combination of cutting spending or new revenues, regardless of whether you're, regardless of what balance you would choose in that. You have to do something really big. On the other hand, if you did this approach, what would be happening with the dividends? You'd be, because you weren't touching any of that, the permanent fund would be growing rapidly because you're not taking money out, and so it would be earning more and more, and you'd be paying bigger and bigger dividends. And so you'd have this permanent fund that was getting bigger and bigger, and you'd be paying bigger and bigger deficits, dividends, at the same time that you're either drastically cutting spending or drastically adding taxes or both. Okay, so presumably this is why, I know not everybody's on board with this, but this is why there's a lot of discussion about, well, no, that's too harsh. Cutting tax only is too harsh. Let's talk about some way of using earnings. Now, what happens if Now I'm going to what I call my do nothing projections. And again, this is totally hypothetical. But it's a thought exercise designed to illustrate something. Suppose you say, well, I'm gonna leave spending exactly like it is. I'm not gonna do anything to change spending. I'm gonna keep on spending what we're spending today. And I'm not gonna add any new revenues. I'm not gonna do any revenues. I'm just gonna keep running deficits. Okay? So if you said, well, I'm just gonna keep running deficits, how could you do that? Well, the only way you could do it would be, first you'd use up the, I hadn't talked about my four other beautiful graphs, so let's talk about them. Yeah. So in this, now we'll see. If what would happen is you would first use up the CBRF, right? Because you got this big deficit. So you'd use up the CBRF, and the CBRF is, the CBRF draw is shown in the...
And Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund.
Yeah.
Okay. Just for people watching.
I keep forgetting. I'm aware I have the world's geniuses on the Alaska budget here, but in the room, so I forget that other people watching, too, don't have the pleasure of doing this every day. Anyway, so if you draw down that constitutional budget reserve, and by the way, the sort of graph on the bottom left shows our three savings accounts, what happens to the constitutional budget reserve, the permanent fund earnings reserve, and then all our other funds, all the miscellaneous funds that have money in them. So you quickly use up that CBRF to fund your deficit. Well, then what do? You're still running this big deficit, so you have to go to the only other source of money to pay for it, which is the permanent fund earnings reserve. But you're doing it without a plan. You don't have a plan like Representative Seaton's proposed or Senator Dunleavy or the governor. They've all proposed plans for how you would draw. Here you're just running this deficit and you're going and drawing the money. It's what I call a forced draw. That's the term I used here. And that's represented by this sort of dashed red stuff. So you have this forced draw. You say, well, we're running this deficit. We've got to go to the permanent fund. And so you start taking money out of the permanent fund earnings reserve. Okay? And that is shown by the middle graph at the top. And that shows how much is the permanent fund earning in realized earnings, and what kinds of money are you taking out of it? And so you're taking two kinds of money out of it in this scenario. You're taking out the dividends, which are shown in blue, which are being generated by the same formulas before, but now you're also taking out this forced money that you got to get out of there to pay for your deficit. And it's because you're taking more money out, and you're taking more money out every year than it's earning, so the earnings reserve begins to go down because you're taking more money out. And then the next line graph over shows your dividends. The blue line shows the total amount you're paying for dividends, and the whatever that color is, of the line on the top shows the actual dividend amount. Your dividend is still rising because the permanent fund is, the total value of the permanent fund is still growing slowly because you're adding two things. You're adding royalty deposits and you're adding unrealized earnings, which is another complicated topic. So it grows. But here's the interesting thing. This is not a, the way these numbers are, this is not a total disaster scenario in a fiscal viewpoint. You project out 10 years and, whoa, the permanent fund earnings reserve is going down, right? It's going down. But it's not like, you didn't sort of immediately run out of money. It's just, you are, however, spending more than you're taking. So this kind of do-nothing thing is, in fact, a way we could go to the permanent fund earnings, right? We could just sort of say, well, let's see what deficit we run. Well, we used up the CBRF, let's go to the permanent fund earnings. But the point is the permanent fund is generating so much money that if you do that, you can actually get a lot of money out. This is basically a way of having a pretty big draw from the permanent fund, but it's a dangerous way. It's a dangerous way because unlike any of these other plans the people are proposing, it's an uncontrolled way. It just says, what do you take? You take as much as you need to run whatever, cover whatever deficit, as opposed to you take this amount that some formula is describing. So this is sort of a default way of just, oh, we got a deficit, let's go over here to this other source of cash. Yes, sir.
Representative Ortiz.
And in that scenario, the do-nothing scenario, what's happening to the dividend itself, to the dividend disbursement to the people?
Well, the way I set this up, I left in exactly the same dividend formula. Okay, and remember, our current formula is based on what's the permanent fund been earning. And so it because the permanent fund grows a little, the dividend grows a little over time. That's what happens. Now let's look at this one. Is the same thing, except I assumed, suppose the permanent fund earns 1% less. Okay? So if the permanent fund earns 1% less, now you have, it's earning less. So if you go over there and say, oh, we're running these deficits, let's draw more money. Let's fund them out, from the permanent fund. Well, if it's not earning as much, then you draw it down more rapidly. Then now your dividends are no longer rising. The permanent fund is sort of getting flat. It's not growing at all. And this one is showing, again, the same sort of do-nothing scenario, but with these varying rates of return, what I call my FY06-16 scenario here. And so what would be happening here if these hypothetical rates of return came true, you'd have widely varying, you'd be running the same deficits, you're drawing the same amount from a permanent fund that's earning widely different amounts every year. So that permanent fund earnings reserve balance would be going up and down under these particular scenarios. Under these particular assumptions, you would never actually run out, you wouldn't fully deplete it, but there's a chance if you had enough bad years that you would fully deplete it. Of course, your dividends would be fluctuating widely, just like our fixed dividends have fluctuated widely in the past under the historic formula, which is because it's built in to do that if the earnings vary.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
So that's where I'm getting a little confused here. So with the rate of return, we don't have a specific amount. We just have to look at past history every year of what that rate of return. Are you assuming that we're going to make a minimum of 3 or 4 or 5%?
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that I have no clue what is actually going to happen in terms of rate of return. I'm saying all we know is it's going to be something, it's not going to be a flat, steady. It's going to be some variation. And so my point was I just picked, the future will not look like this, but it'll look it could look something like this. I'm saying, suppose it looked like this, what would happen? And the point is simply to illustrate with this so-called proposal and the other ones I'm going to show you, the point is simply to illustrate what happens if you don't get, you know, the same return every year. What happens if the returns vary? And the point of this is simply to make the argument, if the returns vary, then your dividends are going to vary, and the amount that and your earnings reserve is going to bounce around in and so on. But there's nothing magic about these numbers. I just use them for an illustration.
So let me interrupt for a moment. So the rate of return 06 to 16 to 17. Are you using a 10-year average there?
No, I said I want something that I can use to illustrate the point of what would happen if we get variable returns. And I said, what should I use? I said, well, what the heck? I just look at some past historical period and said, we got 6%, and then we got 11%, and then we got -3%. You know, and said, what happens if the same thing happened? But this is just completely hypothetical. It might look something like that, or it might look completely different. Maybe it'll go off the charts.
We'll hope only
either direction.
Yeah, right. Maybe it'll go off the charts up. Okay.
Representative Wilson, did that answer your question?
Kind of, but just so like on the next, so when you have the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation underneath the rate of return assumptions, do they have an assumption? Because on some of the slides you have, you know, like 36 or something, you have APFC, which is the...
Yeah, I'll just...
So is that a specific amount then that we're talking about versus the one that we just had where it was from 06 to 18?
So if you... I'm going to show you three slides, and if you look in the upper right-hand corner...
Right.
I'm illustrating these proposals with... I got three different sets of assumptions that I illustrate each one for. And when it says APFC, that means I'm using the assumptions that the Permanent Fund Corporation's advisors have said is here's what we think the average rate of return is going to be, and I'm using those as if that happened. And then for purposes of illustration, if you look at the next slide, I said what would happen if you have exactly those same numbers except they were all 1% lower. And then the third one for purposes of illustration is what would happen if you had these historical ones.
Thank you.
So they're all just illustration. Now I have...
Before we go forward, so in the APA, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation proposals, we're looking at a projected levelized rate, whatever that is.
I don't have the exact...
6.95 or...
It's like 6.9%. Total and you know something like
right. But what I'm meaning is in that situation we're taking one average rate of return and applying it on all the years.
Apply it in every year.
And then you're taking that same rate of return for the other slide and saying what if it was 1% less on average. And then the third one you're saying what if we applied the actual rates of return over a 10-year period, and that 10-year period you happen to pick was 06 through FY17.
Yeah.
So that's the variables that we're looking at.
By the way, the average for that FY06-17 period was actually intermediate. It was about 0.5% lower than the APFC, but it's sort of in between in terms of average, those other two.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, with apologies to Senator Dunleavy for anything I've gotten wrong in his proposal, I'm going to attempt to describe my understanding of it, and I think this is sort of right in the general details, but I'm not claiming that this is exactly what he's proposing. So first of all, he's proposed a very significant spending cut. And the one I don't know if this is exactly what he's proposing, but what I modeled was an $800 million cut over 3 years. And this is based on a sort of set of spreadsheets that are posted somewhere showing projections of the model. So in this, the first thing you can look at is that green line at the top in the left-hand spending line. That goes down. So you cut $300 million a year for 2 years and then another $200 million. And so you cut the budget by $800 million. So that's a very significant part of his proposal, a very large deficit, or sorry, very large spending cut. And then he says there's no new revenue. So you don't add any new revenues. You just stick with the current oil revenues and non-oil revenues. And then you have a permanent fund, a draw from the permanent fund, which, if I understand it correctly, is basically you draw exactly the same amount that you're using for dividends, calculated in the same way, if I understand it correctly. And so you can think before, what historically, what were we drawing from the permanent fund earnings? We have this formula that says, take the average of the earnings over the past 5 years and spend half of those. Okay? And so you were kind of taking half of the earnings, and you're leaving the rest of the permanent fund. And this proposal says, we'll take all those earnings and keep half of them for dividends and use the other half for state government. That's my understanding of the general concept. And then he's also built in some planned drawdown of the CBRF and some drawdown from some of our other funds. Okay? So if you look at this proposal, if you look at the upper left-hand corner, the red there in the upper left-hand corner shows this, the revenues that you start getting from this this draw from the permanent fund equal to the dividend amount. So you're now getting that much money that you're adding to the general fund that you can use to fund government, and you combine that with these big spending cuts, and what do you get? You actually start, 3 years in, because the oil revenues are rising. You get enough money so that your deficit is gone, and you actually start running a surplus. So you build the CBRF back up, and that's shown in your bottom left-hand graph. And so his CBRF gets built up because you're actually you're drawing money. You're running a surplus that you're putting into the thing. But so
before you go on, Representative Pruitt had a question.
Yeah, and it's really trying to understand exactly what you're talking about right now. Mm-hmm. So because that triggered in my mind, I saw the planned draw was more than the spending. Mm-hmm. And that's based on the formula as you understand it it's like a 50-50.
Yeah, and when I checked his projections, and they definitely show you start getting a surplus. Pretty much, not exactly, but very close to the surplus I'm projecting. So I think I got that right. So
and so you in your modeling placed that surplus in the CBR.
Yeah, and I think that's what's intended, and that's again my understanding of what his projections show, that gets added to the CBRF. And so in these projections as shown here and in his model, the CBRF then grows to about the amount here. Okay, so how does he do that? You go, wow, look, a big surplus, and that's great, but it's done by one. It's done in two ways. There's this very large spending cut, or large is in the eye of the beholder. There's an $800 million spending cut, and then you're drawing and this large amount equal to the dividends from the permanent fund earnings. Now, because you're drawing so much from the permanent fund earnings, the permanent fund earnings don't grow as rapidly, right, because you're doing a bigger draw. But keep in mind, there's an interesting thing that this graph illustrates in the bottom right. It shows the sort of components of the permanent fund. And you see these shaded parts? Those are the unrealized gains of the permanent fund. And basically, we're only allowed to spend the realized gains. Okay, remember the difference between realized and unrealized. So if we buy stocks and they've gone up, they say, wow, your stocks you know, gone up twice in value. But if you haven't sold that stock and actually earned more, it's a gain. The value of your asset's gone up, but you haven't realized it. And so in all these models, growth is occurring partly because every year we're getting unrealized gains, you know, hopefully. And that's a source of growth.
So essentially the way that, as I understand it, it's just shifting some of our money, just shifting it from the earnings reserve over into the CBR, and it's just a fund transfer, I guess, in that case. Is that advisable? I would estimate that if we leave it with the permanent fund, that the power of being with the permanent fund would probably be, like right now, with the CBR being as small as it is, we're not.
I guess the way he would probably characterize it, if you, what's happening in the later years? First of all, you're not just taking it out of there and putting it all in the CBRF. You're taking it out of there and using it to pay for government, and some of it's left over, which goes in the CBRF. And I think, yes, you are correct that it probably wouldn't make a lot of sense to take kind of more out than you need and put it in some fund that doesn't earn as much money.
Right.
And so that would be something to think about this. I would say one thing that is an interesting feature of this plan is it's really simple. I mean, you understand exactly what's going on. This is not a mysterious new formula. And also it is, and I think this is the argument of people who came up with the original dividend formula, you never use money except money that you've actually sort of had as realized earnings. But it's, I want to just show you what happened. So many fingers up, I can't talk.
Before we go on, we had Representative Guerra and then Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. I mean, I think you hit on a little bit of it, but I can't see it on the graphs. So realized earnings of the permanent fund, they're not like 6.9% a year. The realized earnings are, you know, I mean, if you have Microsoft stock and it's gone up 100%, but you don't cash any of it out, that's not a realized earning, right? The realized earnings are arbitrary sort of in terms of when you decide to cash something out. If you're running government or your permanent fund dividend based on these realized earnings that are radically going up and down and up and down under this plan, doesn't your payout for dividends and government go radically up and down and up and down?
Yeah, let's skip ahead two slides. This is the same plan where I threw in the FY06, FY16 rate of return assumptions. And so, and because you now have both the dividend formula and the general fund draw based on sort of these earnings that are changing, both of those, the dividends and the general fund draw, go up and down a lot, and so the kind of the money available for, so there's a lot of fluctuation, there's a lot of variation in it. I think yes, you're correct.
Follow up, Representative Guerra.
And then, I'm just going to shock people that Representative Dunleavy and I don't agree fully all the time. Here's the other issue. Let's say you wanted to make sure you had a $3,000 dividend every year. In order to do that, you would force the permanent fund to start selling their stocks to create realized earnings. And if you did that, wouldn't the permanent fund not be able to maximize its return? I mean, if you had a set very high dividend, the permanent fund would have to start cashing out investments that it would want to keep, and over the long term it would start earning less. Is that not a possibility, a real possibility?
It is, and I just very slightly modify what you said. In the past, we've had this dividend formula, which has had a lot of variation. We told Alaskans, hey, expect your dividend to vary. Because it's based on these things and so on. So you don't get to always have exactly the same amount. We're only going to use the realized earnings, and Alaskans have kind of accepted that. Okay. I think the risk we face now as we get into this question of, are we going to start using permanent fund earnings in some way, whatever the formula is, are we going to start using earnings in some way to fund government, Well, in government, people don't want to hear, oh, the school budget is down by half this year because, you know, it's up and it's down and so on. People are going to not, they're going to be much less willing to have that than we are to have had a flexible dividend in the past. And so there's, in general, I think we're now faced with a complicated issue, which I am not your expert on, but if for the people that are managing this incredibly valuable asset that we have, if we say, in effect, if we say, we need more cash, that's what we're saying, the time has come, we need more cash, well, that changes how you can manage things. If we're saying we need more cash, whether it's for a $3,000 dividend or for government, then you run the worry that they're going to sell the fabulous Microsoft, you're going to sell, you know, you sell Kodak before they invent the, you know, instant camera or whatever. You see what I'm saying? So yeah, that's a problem that we face in general. Just the fact that we're saying we might want to use more of this. Are you going to? What does it do to your investment strategy? And does it potentially reduce your earnings over time? And so I think that's a really big complex issue which you guys have to grapple with as you think about any of these plans and how they work. And I guess I defer to other people. I think for reasons I don't quite understand, there's supposed to be less of a concern with that if you use a POMV type payout. But again, I defer to experts on that.
Reverend Ed Ortiz?
And I might be getting ahead of myself here, but as we're looking at these different potentialities, the do-nothing potentiality, the Dunleavy plan, HB 365, and these different models, none of these models project in any way the impact of one plan versus another on the economy overall. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is absolutely correct, and that actually sort of one of my concluding slides is I just want to really emphasize this. All this is doing is sort of looking at the financial part of this, the feasibility, the sort of how much money's going in. That's all this is doing. It's simply saying this is how it would work. It's simply tracking where the money would go. It says nothing about how any of these different proposals would affect the economy or which Alaskans would be affected or you know, does it help poor people or does it help rich people or does it help the bush or cities or is it good for growth or not? All these other things, this doesn't say anything about that. And yet what I would say is, I guess what I would encourage you to do is, this is just a real starting point. It's just these models and is just a starting point for saying, Does this plan kind of work financially? Or does it use imaginary money, magic money, or does it use real money that would actually be there? But then, really, as you debate these things, you have to get into the big philosophical questions like, what's the role of dividends? You know, what kind of dividends do Alaskans want versus government spending or versus keeping taxes low and how all these things affect the economy and so on. And I haven't said anything about that, and nothing I say today is going to relate to that. But anybody who looked at these things, if you compare these different plans, you could go through and say, well, this one would be help these kind of people and hurt these other kinds of people, or this one would help the economy or whatever. But this is just the boring numbers. The real kind of meat of the issue and the philosophical debate that we need to have is in the other stuff. This is just, is it financially real?
And Gunnar, as we look at this, see, the first part is modeling $800 million cut over 3 years, and we get a surplus in the out years. So if we cut $2 billion over 3 years,
have an even bigger surplus.
Then we'd have a bigger surplus.
That's correct.
So just following up on what you're saying is that the you know, we can look at this financial effect on a system that's standing off there, but it doesn't show at all whether it's feasible within a vibrant Alaskan economy.
Right. I mean, so you can have a debate about this, but you know, one person might say, wow, I love that. This cut $800 million, we're going to get rid of all kinds of waste and so on. Another person might say, oh my God, you can't, you know, what are you thinking of doing? You're going to gut this and this that matters to me. And so, but one thing is certain. This is not just an exercise of saying, wow, the deficit gets less if we draw the green line lower. That, you know, that's true, but that's not really, that's not what the argument's about.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I don't want to confuse all different plans. So this particular plan says that we're going to do the dividend the way we do now. Half of it, of the earnings reserve that comes out for the actual earnings, goes to dividends. The other half would go into government. As you get to the outlying areas, you depending again about what the percentage is and how that fluctuates. But there's no set dividends, just like it is now. You might get a higher one or lower ones by the five-year average. But the other question that would be to debate is that if you were to go with a plan like this, as we have then more coming out of the earnings reserve than what we need for government, which hopefully that can happen, then the question would be, would it be better to be putting into something like the CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, which we must keep it in a lower earnings so that we could utilize it, versus not taking it out of the earnings reserve at all if we don't need those in the excess years, so that it can make more money and hopefully keep it plenished up better than if we put it in the CBR?
See, I guess what I'll make a bold prediction. Let's say you went to a plan and it went something like this. My guess is that if you got to a situation like 5 or 6 years down the road where you said, hey, we went to this plan and, wow, we fixed the deficit, and you say, wow, we're taking money out of this high-income earning account and putting it in this low-income earning account, I guess the legislature would more than likely say, actually, let's the heck with that. We don't need to take as much out. You know, we don't need that much. My guess is it would never work exactly this way. Well, I should rush along, or we won't finish by 9 p.m. Okay. Now I'm going to take the risk of totally bludgeoning and mischaracterizing HB 365, which, again, for the people not familiar with it, is my understanding of a bill that Representative Seaton introduced last year. And this is the way I've modeled it, and this may or may not, this may have no relationship to what Representative Seaton is actually would actually propose or argue. So just consider this as a sort of hypothetical thing, but maybe has some features of what this bill would do. So I, for this, have modeled that you actually have a increase in spending to $4.65 billion. And that increase as I saw one description, was due to an assumption about what you're going to need. You're going to need to increase payments to pay off oil tax credits that are due or whatever. So anyway, this is built on actually having a budget increase. So there'd be, if you didn't have a budget increase, it would be a less of a deficit. So then how do you pay for spending? Well, in this plan, it has a feature that none of the other plans have. It introduces a substantial new source of revenue in terms of income tax. And so there's this income tax that gets introduced that gives you $650 million in revenue every year. So you have that new revenue source. And then in addition, you have a 2.3% POMV, or percent of market value, draw from the permanent fund. Now this is what you do is you keep a dividend program, but you, if I understand, or the way I modeled it was, you actually cut the dividend in half, but you keep the same formula except you pay a smaller amount, but calculated in the same way. So this is sort of, this keeps you. You use the same process to calculate a dividend, but you pay a smaller percentage of the earnings. And then you have this percent of market value approach of the average market value of the permanent fund over the preceding 5 years to calculate what's your dividend draw. What's your government draw, which is the part shown in red. Now, under this plan, through the combination of the new, and I'm talking the upper left-hand graph, through the combination of the $650 million in new revenues from the income tax plus this percent of market value draw, you get a significant part of the way, but not all the way, towards filling the deficit.
And remember, as I've modeled it here, you got a larger budget that you're trying to fill, so it's a harder thing to do. So you end up having to draw some extra money from the permanent fund anyway. But you're not drawing so much because of the amount that you're drawing is less relative to what it's earning. The permanent fund earnings reserve is actually going up in this particular model. That's my brief, hopefully not too awful, mischaracterization of some of the elements of this plan. Now, if you say, well, how does that change if you have different assumptions about the permanent fund earnings? So here I've gone to the permanent fund earnings 1% lower thing, and now what happens is your dividends are less over time, but your draw for a government doesn't go down as much because it's based on the market value. If your earnings go down, your earnings go down by 1%, your market value doesn't go down by 1%. It's a slower thing, so there's less of an immediate effect on the size of the draw, and so you're still able to sort of draw the same amount, a similar amount for government. And then the third version here, if you have the variable rates of return, again, now you've got a quite variable dividend, like you've always had, but it's half the size. But again, because the permanent fund draw for government is a POMV thing, you get a much more stable draw for government, and so it doesn't change things that much, but your the value of your earnings reserve jumps around because of that. That's my brief, hopefully not too awful, mischaracterization of what's proposed. I would defer. I know legislative finance has done some pretty detailed analysis of this proposal, and I would certainly defer to their numbers on how it works.
And I would just say that, the assumption is kind of out of character for where the proposal is, because we weren't increasing the budget to $4.6 billion. And when you don't increase the budget, then all those draws don't take place. So the CDR is maintained throughout over time, but we'll get that on the other model.
I certainly didn't mean to characterize that you were sort of advocating some giant budget increase. But I guess what I saw was a particular model version that legislative finance had run, where if you did that to pay the larger oil tax credits or whatever, then obviously if you spent more, you'd have a harder problem. So it's kind of
A little bit out of character, because I've been one of the strongest proponents of reducing those oil tax credits instead of extending them indefinitely and paying them off annually.
I just wanted to put that on the record. I didn't treat this proposal fairly, because I made it fight against a higher level of spending. So it's harder to finance. But I think the point is not the spending level. The point is, the real value in this is this is kind of a hybrid way of calculating dividends. You're calculating dividends and the permanent fund draw for government in different ways. And the dividend goes up and down like it always has, though it's a smaller amount. But the draw for government is more stabilized because it's a POMV concept. Okay, now it's the governor's turn for me to mischaracterize his proposal, or hopefully get it sort of approximately right. And this is the most complex of these proposals, because it sort of changes more things. Here I've modeled, for purpose of illustration, I've modeled this as if you just held spending at $4.3 billion. I'm not making any statement about what the governor's proposing for spending. I'm simply saying that's how I've modeled it. Okay, so obviously the deficit and issues would be smaller if you had a lower level of spending.
Governor, Representative Gary had a question.
Can I just have to be clear about this? Last year he had a much different proposal than he does this year. So are you talking about his proposal last year or his proposal this year?
I'm definitely talking about the proposal that
he put forward in December at the time he announced the budget this year.
This year.
And my general understanding is this has some similarities to things that were talked about near the end of last session, but I don't know. So all I did was I read the language and what he was introduced this year.
But Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. But it would include the hike on the motor fuel tax since that's part of the budget.
Right. And what I want to emphasize here is that in these projections, one thing I know that the governor has proposed is a hike in the motor fuel tax, and I understand that would add some tens of millions of dollars. So if you but I didn't include that in this model. But if you did put that in, you'd see some green bars showing new revenues. So again, this is not really a characterization, not an exact accurate characterization of what the governor's proposed. But I think the governor has suggested something like, if I have it right, well, that motor fuel tax increase would be a start, but we think maybe there should be some other new revenues or whatever. I'm not going to get into that. I'm simply saying, obviously, if you put that in here, new revenues, then you'd have a smaller deficit problem.
So follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
But it really is in the $4.3 billion now, because although we haven't passed the legislation, it is in the budget. So we do have budget items that have been moved from UGF to designated funds, because it is in the current. It is as if we passed it. Those monies are already in our budget. So instead of 4.3, we'd have to add another $80 million to what our budget is, because it's already in the budget this year.
Okay, well,
that's why I'm confused. Yeah,
I follow that. I'll simply state, as you can see, these projections here do not include that tax. And if we wanted to stay here longer, I could stick them in and show you how it would change it. And what it would change is you'd have these new revenues that would raise things a little, and so on. So my goal, again, is not to sort of emphasize the, you know, kind of any of these specifics, but more to show you the general concept. And I think what I want to emphasize about the governor's proposal is the concept for how it would use the permanent fund dividend, because it's more of a change. So how it would use the permanent fund earnings. So there are several parts to it. And one is that there's this, as I understand it, and this is where it gets complex, you have a large draw, a large single draw from the permanent fund, which is based on a percent of market value concept, a 5.25% draw. Okay, and you see you take this large draw out, and then you say, okay, I'm going to take 20% of that large draw, and I'm going to apply 20% of that draw to dividends. Okay, so that's one feature, and then I'm going to use the other 80% to help fund government. But then I'm going to do several other things. I'm going to reduce the share of oil royalties that get deposited in the permanent fund from what it is now, which is somewhere like 31%, down to the constitutionally mandated 25%. So I'm going to get more oil royalties going to government, so the oil revenues are a little bit higher. And then I'm going to use 25% of the oil royalties, the unrestricted oil royalties that we get, to add to dividends. So now, if you look on the upper right-hand graph, the dividend payout that Alaskans get is a combination of 20% of the 5.25% POMV draw plus 25% of the royalties, or no, wait, 20% of the royalties, of the unrestricted royalties. So you get a dividend that is a combination of those two. And so if either of those change, then your dividend change. And if you do this, so what do we see? You end up with a smaller dividend than before, sort of roughly in the $1,000 amount. And there are some other features. I don't think I've necessarily got them modeled right that I think propose a initially for startups some minimum dividend. I might have that wrong here. But anyway, that's the point about the concept here. There's this all the draw from the permanent fund is based on a percent of market value, and that percent of market value is driving part of your dividend, but also part of your dividend is coming from royalties. Here's the 1% smaller earnings thing. Oh, by the way, and under this plan, you build up. You're not spending all the permanent fund earnings, because the permanent fund's earning like 6.9% or whatever, and you're only spending 5.25% of the value on average. So you're building up the permanent fund, and it's growing in value, and it basically covers the deficit the way I've modeled it here. But let me go to the last point, which is, suppose you now have this sort of variable earnings thing that we talked about. So now the dividends, now the permanent fund earnings are varying, but your uses of them are this constant level driven by this 5.25% draw. And there's some other features that are complicated, but I think important. But I'm not an expert on them, but you definitely would want to understand them, and they have to do with some things that would reduce the draw from the permanent fund if your oil revenues rise by a certain amount. So you wouldn't be taking as much out if we get another oil boom. And there are some other features relating to if you accumulate a certain amount in the earnings reserve, then some of that automatically gets put in the principal, taken off the table. So my point is not, this is probably not an accurate characterization of exactly, and so I would definitely defer to Legislative Finance or OMB to sort of show you exactly what they're projecting, how it works, but it's the general concept, I think. Now, I want to move along to another question. Did you say you wanted to finish at 3 or 3:30?
3:30.
Okay, good. So we have half an hour, and that's time to get through the rest of this. I want to talk just a little bit about this question of a sustainable level of state spending. Because there's a lot of talk about this, and people are saying, oh, the sustainable level of state spending is such and such. And I want to argue that this is a more subtle issue that doesn't have a simple or correct answer, and sort of if you ask the question, what's the sustainable level of state spending, I guess my simple answer would be, it depends on what you assume about a lot of different things. So what does it depend on? It depends on all these things. One, what time period are you planning for? Are you planning for sustainable over the next 5 years, sustainable over the next 10 years, sustainable over the next 100 years? Because that changes your calculations. Critically, it depends on what you assume about future oil revenues and investment returns. If you say, oil prices are going to go up to 130, by 2 years from now, and we're going to be getting, $5 billion in oil, well, then if you think that's the future, then we can sustainably spend more. If you say we're going to earn 10% on permanent fund earnings, on the permanent fund, well, then we can sustainably spend more. So you can't have a discussion about what's sustainable without getting into this question of how much money are we going to have, which we don't know the answer to. We don't know how much oil revenue we're going to have. We don't know what the returns are going to be. So all you can do is, in effect, say, well, I think it's more likely that it's going to be this level, but nobody has the truth, right? And so and it's kind of, you might say, it depends on how optimistic or pessimistic you want to be or think you want to be. It's like suppose you're going into retirement. You say, I'm going to live 30 years, and I've got, what's a sustainable level of spending? And I go ask from my assets, I've got this, some stocks and so on. And your advisor will say, well, if you go based on the average of what your investments are probably going to earn, you can probably spend this much per year. But if you want to be really sure that you don't spend too much, you probably ought to set a lower level. So it's kind of how certain we want to be.
And before you go for it, Representative Guttenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in your list there, which I think are all good and relevant, and it's probably another slew of questions that we ask ourselves when we go about this process, but there are a few of them that it would seem to me that you could answer as far as planning goes. So what is the appropriate time period? I mean, what would you be looking at, all other things being off the table? That's that the first question. You want to look at what is a sustainable, and what would you look at for period? Your future, your expertise is not the future of oil revenues, growing our assets, how much you want to pay in dividends, political, raise new revenue, political questions, the buying power question, and the per capita buying power and spending are relevant questions for an economist. So if we were to take some questions off the table, which always helps you being able to focus to get to an answer, what would you think those relevant equations should be?
Going real quickly through my bullet list, I kind of think I think it's useful to plan on about a 10-year time horizon. Who knows? I mean, I don't know, maybe they'll invent an iPhone or something in the next 10 years, or who knows?
What's
whole world could be different. And so you sort of, I think that you ought to think in terms of, well, we ought to come up with something that we think will sort of roughly work, you know, over the next 10 years, and it doesn't drive us broke or so on. But I think a longer time horizon is, it just gets very difficult. What should we assume about our future oil revenues and investment returns? I have no clue. I would trust the experts at Department of Revenue and Permanent Fund and their advisors as having given reason, kind of best guess estimates of averages. But I would say, you want to come up with something that works if it doesn't happen. So you ought to look at a low case scenario. How much do we want to preserve or grow our assets? This is critical. This is a critical thing. If back to my question about how much, if I go to my investment advisor and say, I'm retired, I'm going to live 30 years, I've got these investments, how much can I spend? Well, he's going to say, well, what do you want to leave for your kids? Do you want to you want to be like those people that say with the bumper sticker, I'm spending my kids' inheritance, so you're just going to use up all the money and it's going to all be gone? Well, you know, you sort of made it work. Or do you want to say, I want to live like a miser so I can leave all my kids will be millionaires? So the question is sort of, what can we spend? Well, what do we want to leave for, let's say we're planning for 10 years out. Do we want to leave our kids exactly what we have now, what we have now? Do we want to leave them, do we want to leave them more? Do we want to leave them less? I don't know. I think that's a critical question going forward. I guess, I'm not here to advocate anything. Personally, as an Alaskan, I think our minimum standard should be we ought to leave our kids the same real buying power of our assets as we have now. So if we've got $70 billion in assets now, I think we ought to 10 years from now have the same purchasing power of assets. In other words, those ought to grow at least by the rate of inflation. But I think you can make a reasonable argument for something different. But that would be my personal thing. But I think that's part of the debate. I think there's and then there's an interesting one of, should you be thinking, if you say, well, you have a certain amount of money in the bank, does what matter keeping that the same or keeping it the same per capita? So, suppose you think Alaska's population is going to grow by 50% in the next 10 years, which I gather the economists are saying that's not like that. But if you thought it would, well, do they all need to be as rich per capita, in which case we have to save more, or do we say, well, we're just going to have to live with having less wealth per person? So I guess I would go, I personally think what we ought to be striving for is a level of spending that sort of leaves the inflation-adjusted value of our assets the same after 10 years. That means we're not spending more than we're taking in terms of the real value. But you could debate this a long time. Okay, moving right along. So here's a potential way you could define sustainable total spending: a level of annual spending which preserves the value of our assets.
Yep. You don't. Another question.
I'm sorry.
Thanks, Ken. I don't know when to ask this, but so one of the issues that you presented in a study, I think you were pushed to produce it as quick as you could, but which was, you know, a number of things, budget cuts, for example. How many job losses would that cause? What's the correlation between budget cuts and job losses? And then you produced a preliminary study and a later study. My understanding is now that you are spending less time working. So we sort of stay in this committee. I know that you and colleagues have been presenting in other committees, but that's been refined, I think, the sort of what's the impact of spending cuts on jobs, impact of other revenue measures on jobs. That's been further refined by somebody who's now working at ICER?
In brief, yes, you're absolutely correct. Last year, last winter, I worked on a study that sort of tried to look at implications, economic implications of different ways of reducing the deficit. And after we finally finished that report, I haven't done any more work on that subject at all. I'm not, and I haven't been following what other people at ICER may or may not have been doing. Nobody's come and told me, oh, we did some more work and it changed this or that conclusion, so I'm not aware of any changes to it, but I don't have anything new to say about that, and I haven't done any more work on that.
Reverend Gere.
So there's maybe I'm misunderstanding. I understood that there's somebody else at ICER who now has a projection on, you know, how many jobs you lose for every $100 million in budget cuts and things like that.
I believe you're probably talking about my former colleague and a very fine economist, Dr. Mohsin Ghatabi, and he was one of the co-authors on that study that I worked on. And so I'm speculating that if he said something about, you know, sort of economic effects associated with doing various things, he would have been referring to that same study as opposed to, you know, some new work. But I haven't talked with him about that, but I don't have anything new on that. Okay, so if you get into sustainability, then you face also an interesting question of, if you say, well, we've got to sustain the value of our assets, then you have this interesting question, well, which assets? And should we sustain the value of our spendable assets, which is like the CBRF and the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve, or should we sustain the value of all our financial assets, like the Permanent Fund, should we add in the Permanent Fund Principal, so is it the total value? Or you might argue, well, we ought to be sustaining even more because we're depositing money into the Permanent Fund Principal. This is a sort of subtle point. We're adding the Permanent Fund Principal 25% of the royalties, and the theory behind that was, why are you doing that? Because you're saving for future Alaskans to make up for the for oil that's being drawn out of the ground. And so you might say we shouldn't be, you know, spending that money as we go along. That ought to be accumulating. These are all subtle points, but they relate to this question of what is sustainable. Now, this is the sort of nominal value of our assets as we measure them in these different ways, right? So if you were going to sort of say, well, if you went by the standard I gave you and said we shouldn't deplete these, I guess I would go, we shouldn't. I personally think the number that's relevant would be the third column. But this is the nominal value without adjusting for inflation. And I would say really these numbers are too low. You ought to project ahead how much inflation might occur, and expand these numbers up and say that's what you ought to try to get your value to. But so what's the number, how much you can spend that does that? Well, it depends on what our oil revenue is going to be. And I was going to calculate those numbers for you and show them to you, but instead I spent yesterday evening in the Ketchikan Airport.
But here's a last point I want to make on this before I go to some quick conclusions. Sustainable on paper isn't necessarily the same as sustainable in practice. Okay, so you might say, well, look, I have my plan. It could be one of these plans that maybe all these three plans that we looked at are basically sustainable. They all sort of preserve the value of the assets, and they draw from the permanent fund, but they don't draw too much, and so they all kind of work, right? But they're sustainable on paper because they say, look, we're going to spend this much per year, and we're going to draw this much per year, so it's sustainable. But a plan isn't sustainable unless you have discipline to stick by the plan. Remember that graph. You have to do two things for your plan to be sustainable, not just on paper but in practice. You have to have the discipline to not to over project future average revenues. That's one thing. So what I mean is, if I say I got to have the discipline to not say, oh wow, I we're going to be earning $5 billion a year in oil revenues because great things are going to happen, and therefore I can sustain. You can't do that. You have to be realistic. And second, you have to avoid this temptation to say, wow, our revenue is really high, or the investment earnings are high, we'll just spend a little bit more. Because your plan is built on, has to be built on the kind of average revenues that are coming in. And what I would say, if you go back to that very first slide I showed you about what was our history, we never had the discipline over our 35-year history of having this oil of sort of saying, look, we know it's going to come down, so let's save enough so we can keep this sustainable. So what happened to us twice was we said we're rich, and so we spent a lot of money and we built a lot of stuff and we had a lot of fun, and then it didn't work, and then we had to go through a long agonizing period of reducing spending because it wasn't really sustainable in practice. So you might say this leads to thinking, are there ways you can build in things that actually turn plans that from being sustainable on paper to sustainable in practice by in some way? How can you build in ways so that you actually stick to the plans on the spending side? And that's a whole other question. I want to just four brief conclusions. One, I don't know how you found this discussion. For me, I'm assuming, what's the goal? Our goal is to somehow get to a solution. And there's widely varying opinions in this building about what's the right solution and what should be done to solve the fiscal problem. And so that's fine, but if we're going to get past this impasse, if we can't agree, we've got to have a discussion. And I think the discussion can be helped along is if you use an approach similar to this but more sophisticated, where you sort of run the same kind of projections and show the same kind of graphs for all the different proposals that are out there and use the same terminology and sort of say, how does this play out if we use the same assumptions? So you're comparing them in a similar way, and it's easier to have a discussion. Second thing is, I think that we've got to get to the kind of conversation, if you thought of, since we're having a sort of simple conversation contrasting these different proposals, what you need to think about is the discussion needs to be, we have to be comparing different ways to do things. You can't take any one of these proposals by itself and say, I like that or I don't like it, because we don't like any of them. They all involve a change, right? Or doing something painful that we don't like cutting spending or adding taxes or cutting dividends or something like that. So we don't like them. But the question is, we've got to do something to fix this deficit. So it's sort of, which alternative do we go with, or what mix of things? So the conversation has to be about comparing alternatives. You can't just look at one thing and say, I like that or I don't. It's more, is this less better or worse than some other way of doing it? And similarly, I think you can't, I'm getting a little tired of people who say, I don't like this idea. We have a fiscal crisis, and this guy has this idea of how to solve it. I don't like it.
Well, I think that has a lot less credibility than if you can say, I don't like it, and I think this is what I think we should do instead. That part has got to be in the conversation. We've got to go from here's a proposal, here's why it's better than the alternatives, or I don't like your proposal, and here's why, because it's worse than this other way doing it. There are a lot of ways, you could do this, but they all involve some combination of these unpleasant options of cutting spending, increasing revenues, cutting dividends, or saving less of our permanent fund earnings. And I think we need to get to the reality of that understanding if you don't want to do one of those things, you've got to do more of the other things. So again, it's not like you can't talk about should we keep dividends or should we cut government or should we add taxes. So when you can't talk about it by itself, you have to say what's the combination that's best. And so if you say, you've got to realize if somebody says, I don't want to do, say we got options A, B, C, and D, and if you go, I don't want to do A, then you realize that person's saying, we need to do more B, C, and D. This is the final thing I wanted to say, which relates to, I think, your point. None of these projections tell you which proposal is best. All they do is tell you, does it pencil out or not? Or how does it change your savings balance? Or is it realistic or is it magic? But they don't tell you, I haven't said anything about what's the short-run economic impacts or implications of any of these proposals, what's the long-run implications for how Alaska grows, how would it affect government services, how would it affect the rich and the poor and the rural and the urban. I haven't said anything about that. And I think that these issues that I've listed at the bottom, they're the real questions that matter. And we have pretty widely varying opinions as Alaskans about that. And so I think that you want to, and obviously there's a lot of conversation going on about exactly these things. So these, just showing the numbers is just a starting point for starting the rest of the conversation, which is how do you associate those proposals with these kind of things. So thanks for the chance to talk in the short time left. I'm glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. And Representative Wilson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So your last point. So you're right. All the rest of this is math to figure out how you balance it. But where do we get the data that shows us with each plan how that's going to affect Alaskans, whether it's those who are financially challenged, to those who have big corporations, mm-hmm. to those who, one thing we heard this last year when the dividend was cut, the question was, well, how many people had to go on public assistance or seek out other means to make up the difference because they didn't receive it? But I don't know where you get the data that we can utilize to show that this area here is the best way to go, or this one, because really it comes down to how does it affect the individuals and whether or not we prosper as a state or people move out of the state.
Well, I think in a sense everything that goes on in this building, all the hearings about all the different kinds of things, all the budgets, the budget for the troopers, the budget for fish and game, all those discussions, all the discussions about, different income proposals, discussions about dividends and so on, and all the testimony you gather from these different groups are all giving you feedback on different parts of that. It's just in this big, complicated way. But you're getting feedback, you're getting a sense, you're learning more as you talk to Alaskans, and different people are, maybe they hear it in different ways, we're in the alternative fact world, but I think all that is being gathered through the whole legislative process. Now, there are certain parts of it that you can do like a study of. And so ICER did a study about the first line on there, short-run economic impacts. And said, well, if you cut dividends or if you cut, raise taxes or so on, it has this effect on jobs and income. So for something like that, you can actually get, ICER could do a study.
But let's say you say effects on government services. What's the effect of cutting the budget? That is sort of the sum total of a million different options for how you could cut the budget and how those would play out on schools and troopers and fish and game and the university and so on, and how do you get the data on that? Ten ICERs working 10 years couldn't say that. I mean, you could talk about some of the things, but it's really Alaskans talking to you and getting a sense. That's kind of what the legislature does in its year-to-year business always, some sort of sense of kind of what's the right balance of what kind of government services we want and how much we, you know, give up in taxes or dividends to pay for them. So I don't think, see, you can get, I would say you can study certain kinds of things and get, and I think it would be useful to do that. I think it would be useful to study, if you care about things like how will different, say, rural Alaska or urban Alaska be affected by things you might do, or how will, you know, the poorest Alaskans be affected by certain things you might do. You can do a study that sort of formally looks at that and talks about, you know, say, for example, an interesting study to do would be, say you're worried about, everybody says, well, dividends are really important for rural Alaskans, but so are government services. And so suppose you face a trade-off, then you could sort of look at what that trade-off might be. But eventually I think you get kind of maybe more accurate input by talking to your constituents and hearing all the input you get.
And a follow-up on that, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
So would it be your advice that trying a whole lot of different things and adding a lot of things into it to make the budget balance, or would it be smarter to, as you're possibly maybe decreasing it, adding one or two different ways of doing it, seeing how that works, how it affects the economy before you would add more? Because last year we had all these different things that we could have done. Then if it didn't work, we wouldn't have known what didn't work because we would have changed everything so much. Is it better to go fast or slow when you're trying to figure out where that sweet spot is?
I kind of feel that we're running out of time. We can't just, you know, we've been kind of going, people, you guys have been adjusting to this financial problem for like 4 years now or 5 years, and you've been doing a lot of things that have reduced spending and so on, but meanwhile, the, you know, you look at the savings just draining out at, what, $10 million a day? And so you might say, well, we don't want to go into the water too fast, but, you know, you're going to have to do something, some big things pretty quick, and as we've talked about before, the longer you delay, the less money you have, the lower your future earnings, the more you are at risk, the more Alaskans are left kind of uncertain about what the future is. So in an ideal world, it would be good to go slowly, carefully. There's not a lot of time left for that.
We have Representative Ortiz, Kawasaki, and then Guerra.
That was kind of the nature of where I was going with some of my questions, so I'm going to withdraw.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here, Dr. Knapp. Just a couple things. It was actually toward the end of the slide deck when you were talking about ways to build in within the system to prevent us from spending in high years that you mentioned and then saving in lower years. And I just want to say one thing. When I started in 2007, we owed the Constitutional Budget Reserve billions of dollars because they had spun that down. And by 2009, after changes to oil taxes and the things that went on with the price of oil, we had huge surpluses and we paid back the Constitutional Budget Reserve. We spent money on things that some of the things debatably probably shouldn't have been spent on, but you know, we also replaced Ryan Middle School in our neighborhood because it was going to fall down in an earthquake. So we did have some, I think, some necessity after years and years of having really small budgets. just to point that out. But then the second part to this is there is discussion about potentially adding another spending limit. There's already a spending limit within the state constitution, but there's talk from at least the other body that there might be a spending limit. Is that a way to go, or is that something that you know has worked as far as a way to limit the ups and downs?
See, I'm not an expert on spending limits and how they work in practice. I know we've got some examples of, you know, in Alaska and Anchorage and the state spending limit and so on, of different things that have been done, and some you could argue they sort of work and others they clearly haven't worked at all. I guess the way I would say it is, I think it's well worth having a discussion about the concept of a spending limit and how it would work, but I think it's all, I would think about it really carefully and not sort of say, well, that's an obvious or easy panacea, because there's all kinds of, I think it's well worth having a discussion, but I don't know that, you know, that's not the only way. Maybe, so I think, talk about it, but you got to make sure that it works, and there are real problems operationally, potentially, with spending limits. If you say, I'll just make something up real quick. So say, spending can only grow by this amount or has to stay this amount. And then let's say tomorrow, the president of China shows up and says, we want to buy all your gas, build us a pipeline quick, and so now we have this big project and this growth and so on, and suddenly you got this spending limit and you can't adjust to it. So spending limits are a pretty crude, it's kind of a blunt tool. You know, if I tell my family, we have a spending limit, we're not going to spend more than, you know, this amount in our family this year, and the next year the roof falls in, or we've got a health problem, or whatever. So you want to be, I would advise you to have a discussion on this, but I wouldn't necessarily assume that's the best answer.
Thank you. And we got about 2 minutes left. Representative Guerra.
Gunnar, I was going to ask you, as much as you feel comfortable sharing your opinion, I mean, you've warned us about the various things that cause job losses. One of them is, for every $100 million in spending cuts, we lose about 1,000 to 1,500 private and public sector jobs. We've lost over 10,000 jobs in the last few years, so we've cut the budget by over $2 billion. Under your analysis, that has a job impact. There's been job losses because of what's going up on the North Slope, too. We're in a recession. I think most or all of us would like to minimize the length of that recession and reverse it as quickly as possible. At the point where we are now, with what we have left in savings, with what we've already cut from the budget, I know last year you would have said probably don't do everything in 1 year. Would you now say do as much as you have the political will to do to fix the budget deficit if we're trying to minimize the length of the recession and reverse it?
I think we're in a fix. We're in a bind. And we're sort of damned if we do, damned if we don't. We're in a troubling recession, and so obviously we got to be concerned about how can what we do with this fiscal situation to not aggravate that. But at the same time, we've got the money's running out, and we got to think about the future, and we've got to we've got to come up with a stable way of dealing with the finances. So at a certain point, you just have to live with your fiscal reality. We're not the federal government. The federal government, if they say, oh, my God, we're in the Great Recession, we've got to run a, they can just sort of print money to keep the economy going for jobs, and people debate that, but at least that's an option. We don't have that option. And so I can't advise you what's the right approach, but I think that at a certain point you have to realize that it's not just cutting government or cutting dividends or adding taxes. They're all going to cost you jobs. Some people argue certain things will cost fewer jobs, but they will all cost jobs. I'd say cutting government in particular cuts, you know, real jobs in an obvious way, and it's sort of other kind of, so you don't want to do that, but you also, it also costs you jobs if people don't invest in Alaska, if people sort of leave the state because they just don't see any future here, if they feel that their schools are no good because then that costs you jobs too in ways that are not as obvious. So I don't know the answer. We're in a fix.
Well, thank you very much. We'll hopefully we can get to a answer or a fix to the fix. So our next meeting will be on January 26th at 1:30. We will have budget overviews from the Department of Education and Early Development, Department of Public Safety, the Alaska Mental Health Trust. And at that, we will be adjourned at 3:32.